Wednesday, the 21st of February, 1996. So if you can tell me about your connection with Peel and with the fishing industry.
Well, I was born in Peel and brought up in Peel, and my grandmother actually was the owner of 18 Castle Street, which is now got a big lot of publicity as the Merchant's House with John Slater. And my grandmother used to take in fish workers and different people from well before the war. And I particularly remember when I was a small boy and I went down to my grandmother's house, they were the bosses from what was then Kelsall's, which is now the old Percy Moore yard on the bridge at the field, you know, just at the harbour there. And people I remember, there was a man used to come from Douglas called Camel, and the boss man was called Keg, and there was another chap called Aby. He must have been Jewish, but he was only known as Aby. There were three of them, and they stayed at 18 Castle Street, and they lived in the kitchen. They had their meals in with the family. They were treated a bit differently because, after all, Mr. Keg was the manager. There were fish workers and women. They stayed in the house. Those days you'd come down as a little boy and you'd see all the sea boots kicked off outside the front door and the oilskins just thrown down, and they would be living up in various little rooms throughout the house, you see. And one used to wonder how on earth they ever found their sea boots again, but they seemed to know them somehow. But I knew these people, Keg and Cannell, and I spent a lot of time in the fish yard. You know, I could go in when I was a small boy and they knew me. And one of the things I remember was, in about 1938, Kelsall's had the first fish herring splitting machine on the Isle of Man, which was for splitting herring and making them into kippers. And this machine came from Germany, I remember this, it came from Germany, and you couldn't buy them, and they cost £1 a day to hire these machines. And this was at a time when my father was earning 39 shillings, or just under £2 a week. So that £1 a day for a machine.
What was he?
Father was just a labourer on a. He delivered coal in a coal lorry for Fred Moore, who was a brother to Percy Moore. Incidentally, father at that time, this was a different. Yeah, well, about the same era, pre war, father had his half day on a Thursday, and in the summer he didn't have a half day from the coal lorry, he had a half day which he spent working in the fish. So he worked on a Thursday for Percy Moore, usually a job of dumping fish guts out over the end of Peel Breakwater, for which he got half a crown. That was his pay for the Thursday afternoon. But anyway, I can remember working in this German fish splitting machine, because they said it was so simple that a small boy could work it, and I think I was the first person in the Isle of Man to ever operate one of these machines, and I could just see myself being
today. So how old were you about?
Oh dear me, I'm born in 1929, so I'm about 8, 9 or 10, see, that's all, you know, maybe even less, 1938, you see. I'd be about 8 or 9, and I was stood on a fish box with a big apron tied round me, and I stood there and operated and placed the fish into the special compartments on the machine, and I just operated, and the split fish came out the other end, and this was wonderful.
So it was as easy as they said it was?
Oh yes, really, the machine has been since modified. I think they still go on. The British brought one out afterwards, because obviously during the war the fish trade changed completely during the war. But one of the things I do remember as a small boy, in this machine there was a brush which cleaned out a bit of the fish gut as the split fish came around, and this brush cleaned out, I think it was something known as the swim, which was a little air sac which stuck into the back of the herring, and that helped it to keep, helped it to help it swim, and there was this bit of fish gut that got stuck on a brush, which was a round brush about 6 inches in diameter with bristles, and Cannell put his finger in to take the swim off the brush, and the brush cut his finger off. So he lost his finger, and I remember seeing this. It was horrific when a small boy, yes, seeing this man with only three fingers instead of four. And it's just one of those things that stuck in my mind. And to go on to Kelsall's, as I say, this was Kelsall's, which was a Manchester company, as far as I was aware. And they had as their symbol a gamecock. Now, there were very few trawlers and drifters came into Peel that I particularly remember. But there were one or two came in at that time. And I remember seeing one of these boats in at Peel Breakwater, and somebody pointed it out to me and said, that's a Kelsall boat. Kelsall's didn't have it at that time, but it had been a Kelsall boat, and the gamecock emblem was still on the funnel.
Oh, right.
So that was... I remember that. Well, the other thing that used to happen was, with my association to my grandmother, one of the things I had was to, little jobs I had was to they did a certain mail order trade, where the post would send kippers through the post, but they were never weighed. You got so many packs of kippers for so many pence in those days. Maybe two packs for a shilling and three packs for 1 and 6. It was my job to go to take the boxes, the cardboard boxes with the kippers in, up to the post office in Michael Street and Peel, where they were then dispatched to wherever they went all over the world.
With the posted kippers, I mean, now they're all vacuum packed in plastic. How in the old days did they stop them from leaking?
Ah, now that was interesting. Again, it's just as part of my association with knowing these people because they lived in my grandmother's. I don't want to lose the trend of it. I don't think there was anything relative to the post office, but I used to go after school, and it was an old pram base with four wheels, well sprung, with a box on it with handles, and I would take these loads up to the post office. It's about it's hard to describe what the box was, but I used to get threepence a load for taking these up to the post. That was a threepence of seats. Everybody had to work. If you didn't work, you did. You know, I was in that era. I did messages for a Saturday penny. You know, you did these things. You got pennies, but I got threepence a load, and sometimes it'd be two loads. You know, it's a good day. A lot of people walking out to the castle and buying kippers. But what things I remember was talking to all these different people. There were other people that would be in my grandmother's house. And one of the important men in the kipper industry would be the smoker who smoked the kippers. This was absolutely fascinating. Smokers later on became not so well respected. They didn't appear to have the skills. But it's... right. There's so many different facets of it. In the kipper trade, they split the kippers and they were then washed, and then they were put in brine. One of the things I was explaining to my wife was that above the brine vats, which you saw the men mixing the brine, I think usually on a Monday morning, the men worked on Monday mornings only, and the women worked on Monday morning, making boxes because there were no fish in. So on a Monday morning, they would make up this brine, and it would be tested with the hydrometer to get the specific gravity, get that correct. Now then, above the brine vats would be something in the shape of a clock, which would be either the end of a barrel, or perhaps even just a fish box, with two pointers nailed on, like the hands of a clock, and the numbers, and the numbers from 1 to 12. And when I first saw these, oh boy, I thought they were funny sort of clocks, because they didn't appear to move. Now what happened was, because when they put the herring into the brine, and I'm not too sure how long they were put in, maybe 20 minutes or whatever it was, then the pointers were set the time that the herring came out and they were salted. Now, the men in the yard, who seemed to have a lot of time for me to tell me a lot of things, which otherwise I wouldn't have learned, it depended on where the kippers were going. It was dependent on how long they were in the... If they were going to London, they were salted for a longer time than if they were, say, going to Liverpool. And also, coming back to the smoker would know where the kit was coming from. This would be the bulk trade, because the postal trade made it, didn't make a lot of the business, you know. The kippers would be selected at the same basis for the postal trade, so that if kippers were going to London, they would be smoked in a different way. And this would be, what would they say? I think one of the smokers said to me that the people in London, I've forgotten exactly, but their kippers had to be different from everybody else. They liked a brown kipper because they were used to dyed kippers, so they had to be smoked a bit more often. They smoked a bit longer, I think, pardon. So they were the people in London liked the darker kipper, whereas the people in the north of England, much more sense they knew that the pale kipper, which Manx kippers were a lot paler than the ones that had been dyed, you see. So that this was all. So when you come back to the postal trade, then the if the notice said London, they'd pick out a lighter kipper or what, and you can see little specks of salt on it. You see a bit more salty. So that sort of thing.
But I was just sort of wondering how they actually sort of wrapped and packed them.
They went into a cardboard box, and there'd be a layer of greaseproof paper put into the box, and then folded up, and it'd be packed like that, and tied with string.
Right.
Yes, they were tied around with string, and then I used to have to go up and put the stamp. It used to cost sixpence, sometimes sevenpence, to send the parcel away.
What happened to the bulk of the kippers? Certain amount would be sent for to be posted, and I assume a certain amount would be used in the local tourist industry.
Yeah, but the majority of them went for exports to merchants, and a lot of them would say go to. I had a recollection of Crumpsall Road, but I thought that was councils, but I think it was the co-op. They went all over, and they would be packed up in stone kipper boxes, wooden made kipper boxes, and then the railway truck would come up to the back lane behind where Percy Moore's yard now, and then there was a chute where the boxes loaded down into this truck on the Alabama Railway. And then they went in the truck, and then it was likely taken off down in Douglas and put on the Isle of Man boat. There was a lot of work, of course, in the Isle of Man boats in those days. The boat would be going out early in the morning, and even later on you would see people going down and loading boxes after boxes, but there'd be kipper boxes stacked up on the decks of the passenger, in the middle decks of the passenger vessels.
So these would be big sort of wooden crates, and would they be sort of stamped with the gamecock quill on the side?
No, I can't really recollect the gamecock emblem, you know, just Kelsall's name, which would be stenciled on the side of this kipper box, about 4 inches deep and about 12 inches wide and about 15 inches long, held a stone of kippers. Incidentally, that was another thing that I used to do as a small boy, when I say we all had to work, I used to make kipper boxes. Again, standing on a box to get up to the bench because it was only small, and we used to make kipper boxes. And it's a long time ago, I tell my children, and I got half a crown for to make 100 kipper boxes. And in a good week, the most I ever earned was 7 and 6 months. So I made 300 boxes. And you worked all day. You didn't work Monday because the girls made boxes on a Monday, and the women could make boxes much quicker than they.
How are the boxes actually made up? So what type of sort of carcassing wood or whatever are they?
Just very thin wood, and there were two ends and the sides, and you nailed the ends and the sides on, and possibly you stenciled it after it was put together. Sometimes the wood was stenciled.
Yeah.
I think the wood was stenciled before, but you had to do all that. You nail them all together, and you'd have to do it right to make sure the nails got into the wood. They didn't protrude out of the box, otherwise somebody would catch their fingers on it. If they protruded in, that was no good either, because
the
box wasn't quite as strong. So then we'd be working and getting, as I say, that was my summer. The school holidays went, you know, no matter what the school holidays were like, I was stuck in there, I had to do something to earn money.
So it would have a base and the sides, and then the tops would be nailed on.
That helps to be nailed on after the kippers were in, you see. And they would be all packed up. So there was getting back to the smoking, the smokers, again, you go down the kipper yards at night just to talk to the smoker. today, small boys wouldn't dare do it. So, but as I say, the men, I thought, they were skillful. It required a lot of skill. In as much the chippings smouldered, the smoke went up generally into the back of the kip house, and the kippers were smoked. And then those kippers that were in early in the afternoon and the fire started, they would be complete. They'd be dried, because they were really drying them rather than doing anything else, and they would be. During those kippers, they'd move them about and then move new kippers in to take their place. And this was hard work, working on a plank going into the smokehouse, on a plank about 9 inches wide, and it seemed to be a lot of spring in it. And everything was tarry, it was covered in the smoke tar. And the smoke would have to work very, very hard. And then he had the skill of keeping the fires down low. But they didn't burst into flame. There were instances whereby the smoker would go out and he'd have a few drinks, or he'd nip off and leave it, to the pub for a quick one and leave everything under control. The wind would get up and he'd come back and the kippers would be cooked and they would become soft, and then they would drop off the hooks. There'd be a right round play. But I remember more than one occasion, there was one particular smoker I had. There used to be a good smoker, was expected, man was expected to be a good smoker. There wasn't anything wrong with that, but a bad smoker could ruin all the work that everybody had done, so he needed to be good. But I remember that smoker one night, he said he had tried this, and he took a kipper that was completed from the off the tender hooks, took it down, wrapped it up in greaseproof paper, twisted the ends, and just run the greaseproof paper under a tap just to wet it. And he pushed this in wood chippings, sawdust fire, left it there for, I don't know, what, maybe 20 minutes. And this thing was cooked in its own juices with the heat of this fire. Took it out of the wrapper, and it was absolutely delicious. And I've never really tasted a kipper like it, but I don't suppose many people know that this...
Yes.
Has been done, can be done, you know. So,
so what sort of hours did they used to work in the kipper yard?
Oh, I think the kipper yards weren't so bad. I think they were fairly well regimented by the capacity of the yard, that the kipper would say a yard would take 20 cram.
Yeah.
Well, that was all he could take. There was no point in it, you see. So they would tend to be finished. The smokehouses would be full, everything would be done, it'd be finished at 6 o'clock, I would say, at night. What time they started in the mornings, I don't know. They'd be starting about 8, because I'd be down as a small boy, going down to the quay to see them selling the herring off.
Right.
And the fish sales take place about 7:30 in the morning.
Yes, I wondered if they ever used to sort of end up working at night, because I know in the 1970s that if the boats came in sort of late afternoon, the people would actually have to then do their sort of 10-hour shift through the night.
That may be different, but I'm
boats
really
were coming in
because
so
I
late.
I was an apprentice plumber after the war, and I wasn't no one longer.
I wondered if that ever sort of happened.
This is only recollections of the thing before the war, you see. You know, when it was the fish workers in the herring gutting, salt herring trade, they worked. They took all the fish that was going,
right.
And they would work and work and work.
So they'd probably be working at
they'd
night,
work.
But that
they'd work. They'd
the
work
kippers yards.
They'd work till 10 o'clock at night. They worked. As I heard on the radio from Radio Scotland really recently, they worked till the trough was empty. They were terrible conditions. Nobody complained. They were terrible conditions. Everybody had to work in the same conditions. But it was only in the kip yard, the prisoners of this association through my grandmother. You know.
So about, I mean, how many people did your grandmother have staying with you? And about how many were working down at Kelsus?
Grandmother would have all sorts. She would have because it was a big house, and there'd be people, not only some people working from Kelsall's, but there'd be people working for other bits. There'd be the Kipper girls would come one time, and then the herring, working in the herring, would come at a different period. My grandmother made about 20 girls in the house. Girls would be anything from what? I don't know. Maybe 15 to 60. But you know, they worked hard. They were all very respectable. A lot of them came from Scotland. So I remember one lady coming down play. I think it must have been the Hebrides. The Lewis, Island of Lewis. Her son was called Lewis. The family came for the summer as well. So a lot of the men came down. The men would be working on the fishing boats. Very few, but some.
Right. So they wouldn't actually all be sort of single females. Some of them would actually be married to the fishermen.
Oh yes, some of them, and they'd be just, that was their job. They didn't know anything else. And I particularly remember, again as a small boy, that the older women, they could knit. Woman, oh gosh, it comes back to me now after all the years, a woman called Carrie. She was Scottish. She knitted me a jersey in a week. Yeah. That was only in her spare time, because she was working. Yeah. She stayed, I think, at my grandmother's. Other people took them in, you know. We had some people stay in the house after the war, but, you know, the men came off for a fish. You know. But it was just particularly in regard to that one, and with Kelsall's.
So you'd have the sort of herring girls and kipper girls.
Yes.
And the men you were saying about with the sea boots, what were they?
Oh, these were just the women. They always walked home
they,
in the sea
right,
boots.
They were wearing,
the,
right.
Yes. And the women would tend to look after themselves.
Right.
Very, not much in the way of facilities. You wouldn't get away with it today. You know, there'd be simply a gas ring in the bedroom. And then all the water and everything had to be carried up and down stairs. But the men would live in. The men, food, they'd be in full lodgings. But the women would be accommodation only. Maybe 10 shillings a week for their accommodation. If the men might have been paying £3 a week for the board. Regularly figures would be something like that.
With the, I was sort of thinking, given that, it was a Mr. Keg and a Mr. Cannell. Did they come from sort of Douglas or other parts of the island?
Cannell did. I don't know where the Keg fella came from. He could have done, you see, because they were just strangers to me.
Yeah. So it was easier to actually sort of live in Peel for the time rather than go back to Douglas.
Well, transport wasn't readily available, and they would have to be down at the quay ready for maybe. Perhaps the herring sale started at 7 o'clock on a Monday morning. Tuesday morning. I remember hearing stories about Curtis's, the old man, long time ago. Curtis came from Douglas, he wasn't so well respected. And he'd gone and bought fish on a Monday morning that we'd caught on a Sunday night. And then the story was, and I don't know how long ago, that they dumped the fish and Curtis in the harbour.
Different one, that, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember, sort of, you thought that Kelsos came from Manchester? They had a manager and whatever.
Yeah.
Was a Mr. Kelso over here?
Kelsall.
Kelsall.
No, never saw him, but just, I think his name was Keg. I was going to say Joe Keg, but I can't be certain. But he would seem to me to be a big, heavy man, you see. No, but it must have been Cannell. Joe Cannell. Cannell came from Douglas. My aunt is still alive, living in Kirkmichael. She may know. And the other chap, A.B., I never knew his name. I think he was a relative of somebody. And Douglas was the end of the world.
Yes.
I mean, I got to Douglas not very often. Sunday school picnic, if you're looking. And it was councils, and after the war, different people came in. But there weren't so many. But now, A.D. McAvoy, Percy Moore was the Moores within business.
What did the interior of the Kipper house look like? That you remember?
Oh, very much as it still is to this day. You see, Percy Moore made some modifications to it, but it was just very much it was a two-story building.
And it was inside. It was sort of the concrete floors.
Yes, yes.
And it was just the bare white render walls because it's got tiles on the walls now. So I assume it's just bare walls.
Yes. Early on in the year, I remember particularly one year seeing it. I think he's still alive, a man called Willie Kane in Peel, but Willie's getting old. He used to live in Patrick Street. Very deaf man, yes. Bit reclusive nowadays, I think. Want to stop?
I don't know. The buses are 10 past the hour, or there's one at 5 to 4, which is a school bus, whether that suits you or not.
Oh, that's fine.
That's okay. That's fine.
Yes,
sir. I'm saying Willie Kane. Yes. I remember Willie Kane painting the yard. He must have gone in early, and it was painted with whitewash, and about 4 foot up, it was painted with tarred up 4 foot, but he didn't. I remember asking what it was, and he didn't tell me it was tar. It was something else.
Yeah. Oh, so some sort of
Stockholm tar or whatever, something maybe. Some other name. It's all gone back long before the war. Didn't think I'd remember it all.
So what are your memories of sort of Peel in general, with sort of like the quayside and buildings such as the Salt House, which is now the Pepperell car park?
Well, it's hard to visualise it really, yes. I've forgotten about that. I used to go down and watch them. You know, the men on boats, and interested in watching the fish sales with a man called James Quirk. No relation, he was a fish salesman, and because a bit like an auctioneer today, he could never see who was buying anything, and all of a sudden he'd be there and he'd say A.D. that was A.D. McAvoy, and he'd say P.J. that was Percy Moore, but then he would say Curtis was always the whole name, but
so where was the fish market?
Well, they just used to sell it on the quay.
Right.
Just on the little pier going down from the Weatherglass corner, just down on there. Just used to sell it out in the open. I used to go down, have to get up early and go and have a look at that before I went to school. You know.
Right.
Yeah, but, I can remember on one occasion, just a number of things come to mind, is that when the ringnet boats came in from Scotland before the war, they, people who protested, a man called Neddy Kane, and other working on the Isle of Man fishery boats, and Stanley Gorry, who was frequently referred to as Stanley Gorry, called him Gorry rather than Gorry. They used to protest that the ringnet boats would see the end of the fishing. And can you remember having to take herring up from Peel? My grandmother bought some, and I don't know, my mother take any, but I had to take about a basket of herring, which was quite a lot, in this old handcart of mine, out to Glen Bowie, which is just about 3 miles out on the Ramsey Road at Glen Eagle. So I had to push this on Martley. I don't know when I got back, but I had to push this thing on my own 3 miles out to Glen Bowie, to my grandmother's brother.
So he could salt down the herring.
He could salt down the herring, see what they do. They were cheap. Just, you could see new men that would come maybe 10 o'clock in the morning. I remember a man called Frank Gallagher. He was skipper of one of the Manx boats that belonged to the fishery company. And he had to go to Port Patrick with his fish to sell his fish in Port Patrick. I went home to see my mother, could I go, because I was able to go on the 48 Sons, could I go with Frank Gallagher to Port Patrick, but I wasn't allowed it. How many, 30 odd years before I got to Port Patrick. realised I hadn't missed much. But that's what they had to do, and you would see men, in grown men in tears, who had to take all these fish out and just dump them, because they couldn't sell them. You know, you couldn't sell them out when the people came to the salt herring, they were virtually all sold. And there'd be people bulking them down without, the salt herring were gutted and packed in the barrels, sorted. But there were other people who came. One lady who's just recently died, I never fully understood the term, the Klondikers, and they came and they just salted the herring down in bulk. They weren't gutted, they were just salted into the barrels. And this woman came over, Mrs. Williams, and her husband died, and she married a man called Jack Redford, and she died not long ago. She came over to work in the fish. It was fascinating. I could hear all the old men telling, look at that woman, and she worked, and she worked hard, she could, but still feminine.
Yes.
And she worked extremely hard, very capable woman. She came to work, in the fish. Cup of tea.
Right. So, what were your sort of memories of Peel in general, in terms of things like sort of tourism or the sort of shops in Peel?
I never thought about it very much, you know. It was busy enough when I was a young man, you know. There was lots of visitors coming over. Not as popular as Douglas, but it was quite popular. I remember them as a kid before the war, when I wasn't working. You know, Peel Beach was heavenly. You could spend all day on Peel Beach. Spend all day fishing in the harbour. You know, fishing at the breakwater. If you couldn't get near the breakwater for people fishing. But I was thinking that there were a lot of people used to smoke kippers. They big people. There were some people that only took maybe a couple of baskets of fish and split them by hand. There's a little place in Peel, back at Castle Street, where one of the rice, old Willie Rice, known as Weedle Rice for some reason, Willie Rice, and he smoked kippers in a little tiny shed. There was somebody called McWilliams, Peter McWilliams. He had a little place down in the back, which was Kearns Lane, I think. Willie McAvoy, brother to A.D. McAvoy, there were kip houses built after the war by the government. But these were all these little places all around the town, with just people just doing a few kippers and going out. And there were people, fish hawkers, a reputable business. I don't know, people who made money at it. Willie Rice used to go around with his selling herring. Willie Rice would take one route. He had a horse and cart for a long time. Then he eventually got on the car. And there was a chap called Albert Collister. He also sold fish. I think Albert used to come to the north. I'm not too sure. And then there was a chap called Billy Corlett, who was known as Billy Phil Haig. He sold herring as well from a cart. But Tommy Moore, Percy Moore's father, he started off selling fish from a horse and cart. And they all did this and they all made money, you know. And they just got their fish and they went, and each of them had a different little route. One would go towards Douglas and Crosby, as far as Crosby. Somebody else would say, I think Albert Collister came north. I'm not too sure now, but they'd all have a different direction, so they didn't overlap. And they could take these fish and make bob or two and sell them. So they worked hard at it.
With the sort of herring girls salting the herring, do you remember if they were just working in the fish yards, or were they working on the breakwater and on the quayside?
Oh, the herring, the gutter girls.
Yes.
Terrible expression, it sounds awful anyway. They worked on the quayside, and there are pictures, and I remember them working on the quayside just under the Peel Hill there, where there's concrete, a rough-looking section there now, but they used to work out in there, and they worked in these yards down by, they used to work down on the Mill Road, and these yards with, didn't have any proper surface, you know, rough, and they worked out with no cover. Sometimes it was just a cover, but it was no walls. And they worked on it hard. And there's just even the sun beating down. And the thing about these cutter girls was that they gutted the herring and then they threw them up, found them back, and sold at the moment of at least five different types of herring. Sorted over five different categories. So not only good at them, they sorted them. Yeah. And they stood it. And it would be remarkable. I remember one particular, there were a number, because I was a young, this was after war when I was a young man. They never had any money, mind, but some of these girls, they were, it was like watching a caterpillar turn into a butterfly on a Saturday night. They didn't like to work late on a Saturday because there'd be a dance on it. Perhaps in the Marine Hotel hall at that time, or they'd be a dance on in the cinema, but they would be only on a Wednesday night in Peel at that time. And some of these girls, you'd see them all week in their big wellies and the hair tied up in curlers with a headscarf on it, and when they get dressed up, you wouldn't know it. Yeah, you wouldn't know them. They were, some of them were extremely good looking. You know, they had good complexions for working out in the fresh air.
So how did they used to dress, the gutter girls?
Oh, for work?
Yes.
Oh, then when they'd have goodness knows what, really. A skirt and a top. Maybe a pullover on, because it could be cold. Skirt. But then they'd have an oilskin apron, Wellington boots. Black Wellingtons, as they were in those days, black Wellington boots, knee length. Then there would be an oilskin apron, came with had a bib on it, which came up to their neck and went down a calf length. Yeah. So they were well protected from the water, and then they'd have a headscarf on, and they'd maybe have no sleeves or short sleeves, because they had to work in amongst the fish, and their fingers would be bandages on them, like tubes, with a knife when they were working and cutting these fish. And it was hard work, and they worked hard. As I say, they worked. If it rained, the sunshine, if it wind blew, they worked. They had to work. No protection whatsoever. What on earth the union would say about it, I don't know.
How did the sort of the girls get on with sort of the local people?
Well, very well, I think. Mostly, particularly. The Scottish girls, they were, I suppose, things changed. I used to meet the girls up in the pubs, as everybody else did, but prior to that, a lot of them didn't go into the pubs, and they were respectable people. It was a dirty job, and it was a hard job, but the people were quite respectable, and they worked hard, and this was their job, this was all they knew. They just travelled around the country doing it. They would come here to work in the summer, and then they'd go home in September, and maybe in about October they'd go off then down for the winter fishing down in Yarmouth. I used to think that must have been terrible, to go to Yarmouth and work on that east coast in the winter. I mean, imagine this now. And they had to work in it. Then they'd be back home, maybe up in Scotland, before they came to work in the early part of the year.
So about what time would they come through to the island?
I was around about June, usually came to June, and June, July, August, and away again in September. So my recollection of it.
Is that you're saying about them sort of going to the local dances? I assume that they would actually get to sort of meet the sort of their local sort of contemporaries in age, because given that quite a few of the gutter girls actually stayed on and married Peel lads, so I assume that there had to be somewhere where they actually were meeting up.
Oh yes, being at the dances usually. I suppose a few did stay on. Some of them would have, there would be a lot of friendships between themselves, you know, there'd be, I remember one girl, I always thought she was particularly good looking, she was, she reminded me of Grace Kelly with about another, with about a little bit heavier than yeah. Grace Kelly and much better looking for it, I thought. She married the boss's son, you know, J&G Donaldson's there. They were heading gutters. But again, it would just amaze me as a young man. You'd see these girls in the street walking to work and you'd see them over night and you wouldn't know them, you know. They were totally different.
So, I was going to ask about with the sort of the tourism. Did your grandmother ever take in sort of tourists?
No, not you. No, it wasn't the area that the grandmother didn't have the accommodation to take in tourists. It was fish workers. Which, I think, my heart is reasonably profitable. You know, I had to do something to pay the rates. So. She was doing this, she'd be a widow, see? Big house to look after.
I was going to sort of ask about sort of your memories about sort of Peel in general, sort of what the shops were like, or sort of did you go to Peel Clothworkers?
No, I did to start off, yes. But then coming to work in 1939, I went into the high school in Douglas. I went there for 5 years and things changed, you know.
What are your memories of Peel Clothworkers School?
Never got on with it. Never really, I don't know, I look back on it rather than anything I recognised at the time. And the headmaster, Harry Hill, didn't leave a very good memory with me, you see. Just never liked it. One of the things, there are two things that stick in my mind about, you know, these things. For some reason or other, mother was fairly strict with me, which is reasonable. I couldn't do anything and everything I wanted, but I was allowed to go off on one of the fishing boats during the war. Well, it was a bit of a treat to go out fishing, and it was very interesting to see, you know. When they were using the drift net boats and they caught these, well, the ring net boats, I've been out and seen them, to see these herring flicking about in the ring net, and it was like a snowstorm, but it was herring scales all over the place. But anyway, I went out one evening with my uncle, Tommy. And it must have been during the war. Now, how my mother let me go, I don't know. But I can remember my uncle Tommy taking up on the deck and pointing out to me the lights of Dublin. And there was Dublin all lit up during the war. And the other memory I have too was again, then during the war, I don't know why I was allowed, but I was allowed to go out camping on Peel Hill. Only at the front of Peel Hill, not, you know, just over the bridge with two or three of us, I remember. And this was a night when Belfast was bombed. And that one sticks in my mind too, that you could have read a newspaper, at least the headlines of the newspaper, from the flames of the fires in Belfast.
What are your memories of sort of Peel during the war when it was being used as an internment camp? I mean, did you actually...
Didn't affect me much. The internees came out on the train with us, and they would drop off at round about Crosby and Glenbind to do some work there or whatever they did.
Were these the Italian?
No, they would be the 18B people. Oh, yes. As I recollect them. We had to keep separate from them.
They were actually British 18.
Yeah, well, one fella that sticks in my mind that I can sort of remember was he was Japanese. He was prototype Japanese. And they called him Taffy because I think he'd been born in Wales. Couldn't speak any Japanese in a strong Welsh accent. But he stuck in my mind as this prototype Jap with the name Taffy. No, it was difficult enough going to the war. Good school during the war, the teachers, one of them just died recently. Book, a man called Billy Book from high school. He had to go away and do his military service. The teachers kept moving. We didn't have any long continuity. The clocks were shifted. We had double summer time during the war. And we were going home at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. School was finished and the train was leaving Peel at 7 o'clock in the morning or something like that. We were travelling in the blackout, you know. Yes. It was dark and it was cold and it was miserable.
So it didn't really sort of affect you, and you didn't really sort of notice that one part of the town was cordoned off?
No, we didn't go that way, you know. We didn't go into that. I didn't have to go. Didn't need to go to that end of the town. You see. Go now and again, there were maybe had friends who lived up at the top end of that. They had permits to go through. I couldn't get through. You couldn't get through. You had to go all the way round if you wanted to go and see somebody, which was highly unusual. Maybe I wanted to go and see somebody in, say, Fenella Terrace, then I would have to take another route round. Yes. I'd have to go round by Ballaquen or something. Can't recollect that there was any other way. It always seemed to be so busy. It was, by the time he got to school and he got back, it was homework. And the only thing about this, I recollect during the war, was really didn't know how bad it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you and your parents live at your grandmother's, or did you?
No, I lived. We lived during the war. We lived at Station Road. In Peel, so didn't have far to go to the train.
I was going to ask if, as a child, you remembered any of the sort of the net factories or the sail makers or Tears, the Chandlers.
I remember Tears, don't I? But I met a woman in Ramsey that I used to work for. She was a remarkable old woman.